Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From the independent producer project of KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of true stories and personal documentaries, and today on the program, what keeps us apart? Somewhere between the meet-cute and the final climactic embrace, almost every love story has the obstacle that gets in between two lovers and their shared destiny. On this episode, three stories about that obstacle, beginning with a story from a remote village in Western Canada about a man and a woman who are separated by the sea and who are themselves separated from all the villagers listening in to their phone calls. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
We were hippies. I mean real hippies, not kind of wannabe hippies. In the 1970s, my parents, they wanted to move off-grid in a small hippie colony called Desolation Sound. And it took about 4 hours by boat to reach. We didn't have electricity, and electricity is a good thing. So it was kind of a lonely time. So my sister and I played with crabs on the beach, and we climbed trees, and we made effigies out of skunk cabbage. But one of our favorite things to do was to listen to the radiophone. It was a CD radio, but we just called it the radiophone. It was our only way to connect with the outside world. Sometimes you would get salacious information, like sometimes you would hear that the salmon were running in one bay or another, and so you would run over there to catch the salmon, or sometimes you might hear that the police were coming up in their boat, and that was very exciting information, because why would the police be coming up? The thing about a radiophone is that it's on the radio waves, so everyone can listen, and everyone did listen, because we were all dead bored. And most people hardly ever had private conversations, but there was one exception to this case, and that was a couple who would phone each other every Friday evening at 7 p.m. on the dot, come hell or high water. And I didn't know who they were, but the fellow's name was Joseph, and his partner's name was Hun. Probably her name wasn't Hun, come to think of it, but that's what Joseph called her. And Joseph and Hun were madly, madly, madly in love. And Joseph was a fisherman, and he was out on his fish boat. And Hun was at home, and she was taking care of their family home. And Hun and Joseph missed each other dreadfully. They would phone each other, and they would talk about the most mundane things of all. Hun loved to watch Star Trek, and Joseph would ask her about the last week's Star Trek episode, and Hun would, in painstaking detail, recount every single step. She would always ask Joseph how the fishing went, and Joseph was a fisherman, and he would recount how many fish he'd caught. The more fish he caught, the longer he would draw out the S and H of fish. It was hilarious. So he might catch 10 fish, but 50 fish, or 100 fish. My sister and I would just roll around giggling the longer he would hold his S and H. But they would always end with sobs, where Hun would beg Joseph to come home. She would beg him to come home. She would say, "Joseph, Joseph, when are you coming home, Joseph?" And he'd say, "I just gotta get some more fish." Every Friday from 7 to 7:30. And it turns out that it wasn't just my family that loved what became known as the Joseph and Hun Show. Everyone on the coast, all the hippies and fishermen and freaks and outliers, they all tuned in to the Joseph and Hun Show. And periodically we would get together and someone would say, "Oh, did you catch Joseph and Hun last week?" "Oh, yeah," everyone would chime in. "Yeah, boy, it seems like Joseph had a good day fishing," or, when is Han ever going to watch a new episode of Star Trek? Everyone was so bored of the reruns and hoping that there would be some new updates. We would kind of compare episodes. Someday I might miss a Friday, but someone else would fill me in that no, there'd actually been an exciting trip that Han had taken to the berry patch. And she'd got two buckets of berries. So people were able to fill each other in on the wonderful life of Joseph and Han. After 2 years of being avid listeners to the Joseph and Han show, they just disappeared. One Friday, we tuned in at 7 o'clock, and there was no Joseph and no Han, and we didn't know what happened. Had Joseph come back to shore forever? Had he sold the fish boat? Had Han left him? Something happened, and there was never any explanation. The Joseph and Han show just stopped. I like to think that what had happened is that Joseph had finally returned to Han and that he'd gotten an amazing bonanza of fish. Joseph and Han were cuddled up on a couch watching Star Trek, eating some salmon dinner and having a big bucket of blackberries for dessert. That's what I like to think happened to Joseph and Han.
Willow Yamauchi is a storyteller and freelance broadcaster from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. She's the author of Adult Child of Hippies and Bad Mommy. I'm Bob Carlson, and from KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional. And today on the program, What Keeps Us Apart? Three stories about the obstacles to love. Coming up next is a story about an American man and a German woman who met on a highway in East Germany, 1985. And the only thing standing in the way of their love was an iron curtain. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
It was July 31st. I was an extra in a theater in Weimar. And I went on a bus back home to my town called Jena.
During the summer of 1985, I thought it would be interesting to go to East Germany, to Jena. I was with a friend of mine. And after like a couple of days, we're saying like, man, this is getting pretty old. So we drove to Weimar. We got some fish. There was a good restaurant. On the way back, we saw this bus had broken down.
The bus broke down like halfway, and we started hitchhiking.
All these people, mostly young people, were out in the street hitchhiking. I said, keep going. It's not a good idea. We probably should not stop. Keep going. My friend just slammed on the brakes.
All of a sudden, this minivan with Western license plates stopped. The door opened and these two Americans came out and said, come on in, come on in. And they spoke actually very good German.
Alle rein, come on in, get on in, come on.
One side said, oh my God, we can't really hitchhike with Westerners. And the other side said, what the heck?
And people packed into the van. I turned around to look at everybody and I saw this girl, cute. To my friend, I'm saying, hey, she's pretty cute. I said, if you can get past the hairy legs. And the young girl in the back said, you speak English? And I go, oh my God, she heard the hairy leg comment. Oh, I'm dead. And then she didn't seem to mind at all.
More and more people got out of the car, and I was the only one left at the end. Mark and Terry invited me for dinner. They took me to this great restaurant that was only for Westerners.
In these places, they're watching. You just feel like you're being watched. They knew that she was East German.
I have to be very careful because you never know who would tell on you. And I had some red wine and I knocked over my glass all over his pants. I was so nervous and he blushed.
Our knees just touched.
5 minutes later, he knocked over his.
And it was like one of those things, like a little spark. We took Gabby home. We had to drop her on her corner because we had like a very conspicuous-looking Western van.
It was hard for me to say goodbye, and I was so happy that I have met them.
Get out of the car, gave Gabby a kiss on the cheek. That was it.
I just wanted to run it back into the house. I mean, I tried to forget about it, even though I was hoping he would still think of me.
There was just something about this girl, and I had to go back.
It was about end of August when Mark called and said that he wanted to come back to visit, but alone. We had a wonderful time.
It was an adventure. Adventure is always fun.
I mean, even though I had to be very careful, I couldn't be seen with him. We had to go to another town and we would meet there. Or I would hide in the back of his car with a blanket over my head.
Among her closer friends, they knew about our relationship. And we'd go to parties and stuff. And I would slow dance with her friends and they would whisper in my ear like, Mark, bring me video recorder. Can you bring me video recorder? I said, I'll try. Everybody wanted something from the West. Ketchup was big in demand. Cigarettes, of course, chocolate. And that made me a very popular person.
So my parents, after they learned that I had a boyfriend from America, they were very upset. I said, this is never going to happen. You can never get married. You can never leave the country. So forget about this relationship.
And my father also was saying, you can't be in love with a communist. Oh, my God, this goes against everything we taught you.
We don't know who he is. Maybe he could be a spy or he could be a loser.
They really sat me down to warn me. They said, look, East Germany is crazy. You better be prepared to live behind the Iron Curtain.
I heard a lot of cases where people would try to sneak out and they were caught, and being in prison, it would be too much. I could never do that.
And it was tough. It was a grind, you know. We met in 85, 86, 87. I was probably coming 3 to 4 times a year.
All the trouble we had to go through, I mean, the border checkpoints, the registration, the police, and then I had to go to the Soviet Union for a year, and we couldn't see each other. I was really depressed, and I see maybe I fall in love with somebody else, and maybe I did for a while, but...
And then it kind of cooled off a little bit. I moved to Los Angeles. I remember I had some mail in my briefcase, and I said, I got a letter from Gabby, I'll read it.
I just realized when I came back from the Soviet Union that he is really the guy, and then that I have to marry. I mean, it's love.
It was a long letter saying that she's ready to get married. Please come over here.
You know, apply for marriage and you might get an exit visa. So we did that in 1989.
You know, we had to bribe people to try to see if we could get a marriage license. We always bought Mon Cherie chocolates, some perfume soap. The lady would just take it as a matter of fact, put them in the drawer. So, what are we talking about today? Okay, yes, the marriage. Yes, of course. No word yet from the authorities, but we will keep trying. Yes, we will keep trying.
In May of 89, you know, I mean, East Germany was falling apart at the seams.
We'd just be eating. Her brother would walk in and say, yeah, there's like 300 people down by the Stadtkirche. They're demonstrating. Something's going on. I wanted to go out and check it out.
I was still scared that anything could happen. I mean, the East German government can do whatever they want.
People were still being put into prison and killed.
I wanted to leave with Mark, and I was afraid if I participated in any kind of political demonstrations, I would not be able to go.
I got a job as a photographer. I'm in Frankfurt. I'm getting ready for work. And the doorbell rings, ding dong. I go down, you know, special delivery, telegram. And it just said, we have approval to get married. Come.
We had 25 guests, very limited. We had not much space. Our friends from the West brought asparagus, pineapples, I mean, exotic fruits that we never had. So we had a wonderful wedding.
I remember Gabby walked into the church wearing this wedding dress that I had never seen. It was absolutely beautiful. She had the veil over her head, and she came in, and she was shaking. And I knew about the dress, and that the material had been smuggled in from the West, and that the seamstress was sewing the dress for no money. Then we were summoned back to this office, and the woman said, I have good news. Your exit visa is granted. Here's the catch. You have one day. You have to decide. And this is the day you leave, but you cannot come back. I really very much wanted to stay. because you could sense that something was going to happen, good or bad.
I just thought, let's get out of here. Because I never thought that things would change. People were demonstrating in front of the U.S. Embassy. They were trying to get in. It was just very scary. Let's just pack everything up and leave.
It was that sudden?
And we packed mostly clothes, socks, I mean, just the basics.
I remember that scene where her sister gave her this white cotton blouse that had the little colorful needlepoint of like a clown holding these colored balloons.
I was like in tears. I mean, I love that blouse so much and I still have it.
And then she took that in the car and we drove away. We had still the white streamers on the car from the wedding. We drove out over the Autobahn. And that, now it was getting really crazy. There was no one on the Autobahn. There was only police. And we had to stop every few miles and show them our exit papers.
I still was thinking, yeah, they could still turn me around at the border and say something is missing in that passport. Maybe a stamp is missing that's supposed to be there.
She saw for the first time what it was like to go through this huge border complex. We showed the exit papers, and they let us proceed through the border. We drove over the bridge through the no man's land, and there's a certain part where you pass this tower. Once you go past that, you know you're in the West. And I just leaned over, I said, you're free, you're free. I thought, honestly, that we were gonna stop and jump up and down, pop the champagne. You were very quiet, you were very quiet.
I was shaking, I couldn't believe it. I was free and it's finally over. This whole burden comes off you. Dallas was, yeah, much better for me. And we had an apartment from our friend Terry, that the man who was with Mark when they picked me up hitchhiking. Yeah, we're driving down this one big road in Dallas, and all of a sudden we turned the radio on and heard that the Berlin Wall fell down.
We didn't have a television set. So we ran to, like, a bar, and people were watching the people dancing on the wall, these iconic images now.
Reporting tonight from Berlin.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go.
I was like in tears. I couldn't believe it. Who wouldn't like to experience that moment of freedom on the Berlin Wall? But what can you do? It's love. I mean, you really learn how you can get over obstacles and you grow stronger together than on your own.
That was Mark and Gabby Hayes. The story was produced by Kirsten Zilm, a radio producer based in Los Angeles. I'm Bob Carlson, and from KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional. And today on the program, What Keeps Us Apart? And we close with a story about a young rock and roll drummer who declared his quest to find love in song, and how that dream may have become the very thing getting in his way. He spoke to producer Alex Kappelman. From KCRW and KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
The song Multi by The Barbarians isn't your typical love ballad. It's not even really a love song. Let me explain. It starts off with an inspirational message from Multi himself, the guy who the song was named after.
I remember the days when things were real bad for me. It was right after my accident, when I lost my hand.
Multi was The Barbarians' drummer, not their lead singer. And maybe that's why his sincerity comes through so strongly on this recording. The song is a message for the underdog, to anyone who feels different or strange. If Multi can become a rock star drummer with just one hand, you can also make your dreams come true. Multi! The inspirational message continues through the second verse and the second chorus. And then we hit the third verse, and the song takes a starry-eyed turn. Multi's living the dream. But he's still missing one thing, love.
Now there's just one thing that I need, not sympathy, and I don't want no pity, but a girl, a real girl, one that really loves me, and then I'll be the complete man. So I'm gonna tell you, right now, let's go!
And the chorus hits, and the song fades out, and that's it. We don't know what happens to Multi. Does he get the real girl? The one that really loves him? So I got Multi's number and gave him a call. He was pretty chatty over the phone. A little cocksure, but friendly. Then I asked about love, and he shot me down. I don't discuss my private life in interviews, he said. But I figured I could get something out of him anyway. So we met up, and we started talking about his childhood in Provincetown, Massachusetts.
I grew up on the beaches and sand dunes of P-Town. We had a wild town there, odd, and I was the oddest and wildest. And I was like a dynamite stick, ready to go anytime in any direction. I was full of gusto and life, you know?
Maybe a little too much gusto, because when he was a teenager, Multi did something that would change the course of his life.
When I was 14, I made Dad bomb. We'd make them all the time, blow them up in sand dunes, whatever. Well, the kids, we all did that in those days. But this one was a big one, and it worked good. I put a thick steel pipe, 2,000 match heads, chopped up nails and glass or shrapnel, closed the ends up, and then we would, some kind of wick system or whatever, to set the thing off. It blew up when I was making it. When the bomb exploded, I was thrown straight up in the air for around 15 feet. As I was in the air, I blacked out. When I landed on my back, I came to. And then I looked around, and I didn't know what was going on at first. And then I realized all at once, and it came right to my mind, oh no, the bomb. It was a sick feeling, a very awful sick feeling. It was because I was so badly hurt. The minute I saw my arm, I said, oh my God, my whole life's changed. So it wasn't easy as a youngster, you know. You don't want to make a fool of yourself anyway, especially if you want to ask a girl to go out to a dance or to anything, you know. And now all of a sudden, I've got one arm, a hook. That was probably the toughest thing growing up, the self-consciousness of it, and it bothered me. It was not easy.
There was one thing Multi could turn to. After he lost his hand, his family decided to buy him a drum set. He figured out that he could make a special notch in the bottom and the back of his drumsticks that locked into his hook. And he just started practicing and practicing until it became his thing.
My comfort zone seemed to be on my drums. When I went on those drums, I was okay. I could, I'm confident there. This is my spot.
Tell me more about trying to, you know, practice and learn how to play drums with a hook.
With a hook? Well, I always just used to play like mad. Boom, bang, everything you could think, just go. Sometimes you go for hours. Just go, oh, you're playing. And all of a sudden, hey, that's how that goes. Oh, yeah, it fits right in there, you know, just by doing it. And so I did it a lot.
Multi got really good. He started the Barbarians, and soon enough, they signed to a label. They even shared a stage with the Rolling Stones and the Beach Boys and Chuck Berry for a live concert film called The Tammy Show. They played this song, Hey Little Bird, in the movie. There's a great part where the camera cuts to Multi on the drums and he's shaking his big mop of hair around like Animal from the Muppets. He's got a huge smile on his face. He's really enjoying himself. He's young, he's a rock star, and he's surrounded by screaming girls. After all, Multi did have the ladies in mind when he started playing.
If I could only play the drums in front of girls and show off in front of the girls, I'm serious now. Oh, I could just picture myself playing those drums in front of the girls, showing off. Well, look at me, kind of, you know. Two guys with guitars. I don't know if they're in tune or not. I could care less as long as I was showing off in front of those girls.
You were telling me over the phone that when the song came out, like, there were a lot of women that loved the song and, like, seemed to be really into you.
That's a pleasant way of putting it. Yes.
What's the other way of putting it?
They wanted me. Yeah, that's the way of putting it. Baby, I want
you. The dating came as a flood automatically. I didn't look for it. It was just there. I couldn't handle it all. You weren't trying to date as much as you could. It just happened.
Multi might talk a big game, but when it comes down to it, he really is idealistic about love. And he might have enjoyed the benefits, so to speak, of being a rock star, but he never lost sight of finding the one.
I knew that someday I'd want a girl, a real girl, one that really loved me, not loved me because I was in a rock band, not loved me because of this or that, not loved me because maybe they figure I'd be a good paycheck every week if they married me because I was famous at the time. But I wanted a girl that really loved me because I had in me that kind of love that I wanted to love back. I always searching for that, always.
The Barbarians broke up in 1967. And a few months after that, Multi got married. So, is the mystery solved? Can we say happily ever after?
So I guess in a way, I mean, you can say that you found love, right?
No.
But did you think you had?
Then?
Yeah.
No.
So then why'd you get married?
I have two kids. In those days, you did the right thing. At least I did. The best I possibly could.
The best he possibly could was 10 years. Then he and his wife got divorced. Shortly afterwards, though, he remarried, and he's been with his wife for over 35 years. But he was still dodging the question about love.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we play this game?
All right, let's play a game.
You know, it'll be like All the President's Men, right?
I don't know what that means, but go ahead.
If you have found true love, mm-hmm. Don't say anything for 5 seconds.
Oh, that's a foolish game. That's foolish. If I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to tell you. There's no way you can get around for me telling you anything if I'm not going to tell you. Right?
Multi lives outside of Boston now. He still plays music, but he makes his money from his carpet and upholstery cleaning company. He seems pretty happy. And 50 years after he wrote the song, he has a lot of thoughts about love.
Would you like the real one?
Of course.
Yeah. One that really loves you? Would you feel complete then?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe. We'll find out.
Well, that's why I said in the song, I want to feel, then I'd be a complete man. That's what makes you complete.
I like you a lot, Multi.
Let me tell you something. I know what true love is, okay? You know I know that part, right? How can you know what true love is? How can you know what true love is?
I can know what true love is because... Well, I mean, I guess I thought that I was in love. I think that I've been in love several times, but I'm not quite sure. I don't know about true love.
You don't fall in love several times if it's true love, if that helps you any. You know, it's much more rare than that. You know, it would be a once in a lifetime, maybe twice, but true love is very, very uncommon.
I keep asking about this because I really want to know. I want to know, like, what happened to Multi? Did he find true love? Like, I think that's what so many people do when they listen to the song.
Look at me. Did I find true love?
Multi!
That story was produced by Alex Kappelman. An earlier version of this story was heard on the How Sound podcast, and a podcast called Pitch. Alex Kappelman is a producer at Pitch, a podcast about how music affects all of us. You can find photos of the people in these stories and other information at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional, where you can also find an archive of all the past episodes of the program. Today's episode was produced by associate producer Nick White. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. You can podcast this program on iTunes or however you like to hear podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, @Unfictional. Like us on Facebook. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional on KCRW.